Hello, this is Ariski Daoud of Mayor Risk LLC. This podcast, recorded March 1st, 2019, is an unscripted chat with my colleague Alessandro Bruno on the state of the Sahel region. Thank you for listening. Good afternoon to you, yes. Alessandro. I hope you're doing well. So let's have a little chat about the Sahel or whatever comes to mind specific to the North African Sahel, for sure. There's a lot happening. But I think today we've agreed to talk about what's happening down in the four or five Sahelian countries.
The G5.
The G5, yes.
The G5 of Africa.
Yes. So in continuation, and this is going to be my introduction, so in continuation of what we've seen over the past several years, the two biggest flashpoints in the region in the north is Libya, where you have a proliferation of problems, one of which, the most recent one, is a new Haftar, Marshal Haftar, self-proclaimed Marshal Haftar's focus on the southwest region of Libya, which is obviously an extension of the Sahel as well.
Yes, and it's also oil-rich.
Exactly, it's mostly oil-rich, really. I think the focus is because it's oil-rich. Ironically, they really haven't focused on the southeast of Libya, which I'm not an oil expert, so I don't think there's a lot of oil fields there, but in the west is definitely a problem.
Yeah, the west, but and the east. The east has, it depends where you consider Kufra to be, but Kufra is a very important oil and water resource.
Yes.
The main well for the Great Man-Made River is in Kufra. Now, I don't know in what state the Great Man-Made River is now. I understand that during the 2011 humanitarian, in quotation marks, bombing by the NATO coalitions, they destroyed that infrastructure. So, but that is a very important, let's not forget, these are areas, the Sahel and Libya, they are two deserts. These are areas occupied by two deserts.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from our observations of what's going on there, and we're going to go through a few countries, but let's start with the southern part of Libya. Because it's significant. I know that many people would say, well, you know, perhaps it shouldn't be considered the Sahel. But I think it should be considered the Sahel, given both...
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, I mean, given both the geography and the ethnic makeup. So speaking about ethnic makeup, I think what we've seen recently is as the LNA, that is the Libyan National Army, moves into the southern part of Libya, There has been this increase in ethnic conflicts, pitting the Arab tribes against the Toubou tribes, and that's been causing a lot of headaches, a lot of issues, not only with the war itself, but from a humanitarian perspective. Any thoughts on that? I mean, what's your take?
Well, during Gaddafi's time, these problems also existed. The same similar ethnic rivalries, and there were resistance. I myself witnessed a village in an oasis that was razed to the ground, and this I'm talking about the mid-90s here, due to a, let's call it a mini rebellion in this area of ethnic I believe they're Tuareg related. I mean, these are people who are, that's the problem too, they're not necessarily Arabs, and they're people who are nomadic. So, nomads are like a thorn in the side of countries that are trying to establish some kind of national identity and national institutions. Yeah, in the region, they're always to use a mild word, scrutiny.
Yes, yes. In fact, you're absolutely right. I think that there are really two sub branches of the Tuareg world. And one is sort of the so-called Arab Tuaregs, which basically trace their origin to the north and the northeast, namely, you know, coming from the Arabian Peninsula. But there's also the so-called Tuareg, African Tuaregs or Black Tuaregs. It's hard to separate them culturally. If you look at some of the Tuaregs that live in, let's say, in Algeria, for instance, the skin color, the ethnic identity may not necessarily come into play. They often speak the Tamazight language as well, so there's a lot of things in common.
Yes.
However, we know when foreign powers or regimes start to get involved with trying to meddle and trying to divide, to conquer, those differences suddenly appear. And that's what you see happening between the Tubus and...
Yeah, they put the accent on it. The most important theme that I see in the next year or so and beyond is the increase of international meddling in this area. First of all, France is definitely increasing its presence. And military and paramilitary, in the sense economic, military disguised as economic. Mm-hmm. And the United States also wants to get back into the game. John Bolton, I believe, said something, his usual comical style, unintended comical. He wants to intervene in the Sahel in order to stop the encroachment of Russia and China in this area. So he wants to save the Sahel from Russian and particularly Chinese intervention, the same Chinese intervention that is building infrastructure all over Africa, often at its own expense or with very convenient loans.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you have sort of some Europeans that really have generally not played any role militarily and all of a sudden want to be part of a military solution. We have an article on the North Africa Journal talking about the Danish deciding to increase their troop presence in Mali, quote unquote, to help the French secure the region. Uh-huh. and also to prevent, obviously, illegal migrations towards Europe. But I agree with you. I mean, what has been a region, full of foreign troops is going to be a region that's going to have even more foreign troops involved there, for sure. But going back to to focus on the southern Libyan part, which I think is very, very important, because there's this dimension of ethnic dimension of Tubus versus Arabs, so-called Arabs. There's also the presence of Chadian rebels there, who most likely a lot of them are Tubus as well. But removing the ethnic identity, those are people who are against the Chadian president Idriss Deby. And,
yes.
And who have become a thorn in sort of the Libyan crisis, prompting the French to, as you pointed out earlier, to magnify their presence. In fact, there's been incursions from Libya into Chad by so-called rebels that the French Air Force was requested to intervene and intervened to basically destroy a bunch of that. So, again, this drama happening in southern Libya continues to pull the region into a darker place.
Yeah, and then we have, that's the northern pole of the instability, and which began in 2011. Then we have the other one, which is perhaps a direct consequence, but almost immediate, the jihadist revolt in Mali. That's causing the weakness on the southern end, on the southwestern end. So you've got the Sahel squeezed between these two poles of instability. and none of them have been resolved since 2011. In fact, things are building and bubbling, and the reasons for the jihadism, it should be noted, throughout the region, the reason is not necessarily religious. The religious fervor seems to be a secondary aspect of this. It's just a tool. There is real poverty, and in some cases, I think the desire for some kind of stability is what's driving people to join and support some of these movements, just as happened in Somalia with the Shabab during the total anarchy. Not that Somalia is, well, it's a little bit better now, but of the early 2000s, the Shabab came up and got support. And after all, how did ISIS get support in Iraq, in Mosul, when it stepped in? For many people, it seemed like a force for stability, because the new government of Iraq was not paying any attention to these predominantly Sunni areas, which once supported Saddam, and then divided with the Kurdish strong Kurdish minority. So you have, I think, the problems. Unfortunately, we are still talking about the same problem. The demise of the Gaddafi regime and the way it happened has caused a true a quicksand. Everything in the Sahel, and everything continues to sink.
Yes, absolutely. I think just to sort of use the example of Libya, like you mentioned, the demise of the Gaddafi regime, a very bad regime, by the way, intensified sort of the crisis in the region, obviously, to the point right now where destabilization may take place in places that that shouldn't be destabilized. For instance, the fact that the Libyan army is putting the squeeze on militant groups, criminal gangs, foreign fighters, etc., that are in southwest of the country, that's putting another squeeze on the Algerian military, because now they actually have to put new assets to monitor the borders, and those are very long and hot and crazy borders that are very difficult to secure. But now more spending is necessary in a country that basically needs every dollar to control its population.
Low oil prices, yes.
And so if I had to use my gut feelings, I would say that there's been probably an agreement between the French military and Haftar's military, the LNA, so that basically Haftar would be looking at pressuring or pushing for a campaign in the southwest, while the French military, in particular the Air Force, would be monitoring and keeping an eye on the border areas with Chad. So you actually have a joint force, if you will, that would put an enormous pressure on anybody that is not supposed to be there legally. Now, what do you do with the fleeing militants and insurgents and criminals? Well, you're going to have to let Algeria deal with it, because Niger, in the north of the country, which is sort of south of Libya, is taken care of by the American drones. So anything that's happening there is likely to be checked by the U.S. Air Force, and who knows who else. So again, that's really a disruptive model that's going on, that's happening, and could accelerate. Now, just to continue on the thought about southern Algeria, which again, for a lot of people, that's kind of not the Sahel, but we will include it because it's the Greater Sahara Desert. And things are happening there.
Yes.
Things are happening that people may not pay attention. For instance, every week there are hundreds of people that are arrested along the Mali border and the Niger border with Algeria, within the Algerian territory, under the category of illegal gold mining. These are people that come in, I don't know from where. Some of them are Algerian. Some of them are foreign nationals, with four-wheel drives, with trucks, with dynamites, with mining equipment, by the thousands. And those arrests are happening on a daily basis. And it's creating a sense of a rush that we've seen happened in countries like Chad, for example, where it really created a lot of insecurity, a lot of destabilization, and obviously a big headache for government. So the Algerians are clearly putting a lot of resources there, but there is a fatigue within the Algerian military and the gendarmerie, and it's getting very, very difficult. And that part of that comes from the destabilization of the Sahel in general. And you can see that in what's happening there.
Yeah, and to add to the Sahel destabilization, the gold is a newer phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll increase because gold prices are on the way up now. There has been a reversal, of course, and especially with the instability in global politics in general, I suspect the gold prices will increase even further. But the Sahel has three major businesses going on. Most of us have heard about the migration business. That seems to be, but that's only the third most important. Number one is the smuggling of narcotics. Then you've got the insurgencies, and then you've got the migration problem. So there are three very important phenomena happening. New quests add to that. You know, you've got the desert gold rush and former colonial powers that want to reestablish the concept of Francafrique, which was invented by President de Gaulle's assistant. I forgot his name, Fosson, but in the 50s and 60s. So you have, funny enough, Macron, which complains about nationalisms in speeches in Europe, but who at the same time is pursuing a very expansionist nationalist policies in its former colonies, in France's former colonies. So, and then you've got the United States that wants to get mixed in. Russia and China are, but mostly China is there to extract resources. It's a real, I don't know, very mixed up soup. And in this strange mess, the big question is, when are the real resources to solve real problems? I mean, we need agriculture to be stimulated in these areas, because most of the people who are leaving to go to Europe in the first place, and then who also fill the recruit lists of the, let's call them, an umbrella jihadist groups, are coming from rural areas, from agricultural, former agricultural areas, or areas that were never developed. I think if you want to stop any of this, the guns are only going to are not going to cure. They're just going to deal with the symptoms.
Yeah, but I'm going to be a little more cynical than that, Alessandro. I feel bad being pessimistic, but. I came to the conclusion, and again, my gut feeling is that there is absolutely zero appetite for finding solutions to appeasement or to peace anywhere in the region.
Oh, no, I'm agreeing with you.
There's absolutely none. I mean, think about it. If, just take the Mali crisis. This one could have been avoided if the people in power, if the Western powers, the local powers, the regime, etc., decided to give a voice or to hear the grievances of the Tuaregs, who were looking for some level of federated state or federal model, so that they can avoid the harassment of the Malian military and the southern and the dictate coming from the southern from the southerners. B, they wanted some economic opportunity by being able to handle their own affairs economically, while most of them admitted they could not split from Mali. So let's remain Malians. But on the other hand, we don't want to be harassed by the security services, coming from the south, and we want to have some decision-making capability on the economic front so that we can improve our living. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that, chief of which is Paris. The French would never want to have a federal model in the region because all of a sudden they will lose potentially a lot of the control that will go towards competing foreign powers, including the Qataris and the Saudis with their...
Well, the Saudis are already involved.
Yes, absolutely.
They're financing the G5, the G5s. In fact, I believe France, I forgot who, wanted to sell some more airplanes or weapons to one of these countries, and they went to the Saudis to ask for the financing. So far, it hasn't happened.
Let's, in the EU, France is by far the top military power in also in production, and it's the one nuclear power. So
that's right. Particularly
if Brexit ever happens, it'll be left as the supreme military leader in Europe, and it's probably salivating at the chance of restoring some kind of, I don't want to call it an empire, but certainly something akin to that.
Yes. Look, we often talk about Macron, but Macron is a young guy, and he came in very inexperienced. And what you see in Paris streets with the gilets jaunes, with the yellow vests, is a reflection of a man of a president who, no matter how much he loves his country and he's the president of a very powerful nation, at the end of the day, there's been a lot of policy blunders that allowed his aides, who wanted to have a different take than the people that they replaced, and pushed for policies that are absolutely extremely unpopular. But my point being is, the policy blunders that Macron has brought into the French economy and et cetera is also reflected in foreign policy and in African affairs policy. It's adventurism. I think some people call it adventurism because what is the end game? End game?
This is the big issue. What does France hope to gain from this? And what do these former colonies have to gain from France's presence? The European Union remains a power. I believe the biggest contributor to development, but it doesn't have the economic recovery in Europe. Really, hasn't been that strong, and we see some of the problems in Tunisia, for example. Which depended a lot on European aid. Did you know that in Tunis, since Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in 2010, some 2,000 people have attempted the same thing?
Oh, I'm not surprised. Yes, absolutely.
Nothing has changed. The conditions, the economic that led to the so-called spring in the air have not changed. And I think... In the meantime, we've got the turmoil, the boiling in the Sahel, which is right below all this area. Former colonial powers that all of a sudden feel encouraged to move in, and it's a real, it's a very strange mix. This is, without any end. I don't understand where the end is.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's clear. It's for some of them there is the cover face. Specific keywords Denmark uses, well, we're quote unquote we're helping France. The Italian
Denmark may want. I think Denmark may want some because of Brexit, perhaps some Airbus factories, and because what's going to happen to Airbus, which is a European Union project, when England leaves. So I suspect Denmark is is looking for some concessions on that front.
Yeah, it's possible. And the cost for Denmark is pretty minimal. I think we're talking about a couple of helicopters and 70 troops. Yeah. So it's not a lot. It's mostly a symbolic gesture, but one that has a lot of political significance. And part of that is, okay, what is the end game of the lead architect in this, which is France? And I don't know. I mean, if you look at the past week just in Mali, you start realizing that it's all about guns and nothing about roses.
Yes.
Today is March the 5th, and we had 9 soldiers of the G5 killed in Mopti, that is central Mali, from the explosion of an improvised device, an IED. If you look at the 27th, a few days back, 17 civilians were killed in the same area in Mopti from a booby-trapped corpse in the same region. If you look at the 25th, similar, you know, generally in the same area, French warplanes again striking jihadists, suspected jihadists, because there's no way to double check it, to independently check that, killing 15 of them. And it's on and on and on and on. On top of that, you have, of course, the French recently reporting the death of the killing of an Al-Qaeda leader. His name is Jamal Okasha. He's of an Algerian origin in the same area. And then on top of that, you have this devastating environment that is turning a very difficult land into a more desolate one, for sure. So, you know, if the end game is to use, you know, military force to eliminate more people, well, the people that you're trying to eliminate are eliminating more people as well. It becomes a nasty zero-sum game, and that's got to be a better way.
And that's the problem. Who are you fighting? Even if you have this military, I mean, nothing's going to get resolved until really some kind of institutional building takes place rather than military. We've got enough military power, and these people seem to be able to set up improvised devices and keep killing each other with, despite the increased presence of foreign and well-armed forces. So even the military interventions seem to be going nowhere. Or maybe that is the goal. It's just to provide business for military companies at home. That is the only reason I can imagine. By the way, do you remember a certain fellow called Bel Mokhtar?
Yeah, Mokhtar Bel Mokhtar.
Yes.
The one-eyed guy, the Marlboro man. Yeah. Oh,
apparently he's still alive.
Yes, well, it's possible. I mean, this guy has been killed a dozen times or more.
Yes. Yeah.
Nobody really knows. But
yeah, and he's operating in these regions as well. Actually, what do you think? We're going to come up to an Algerian election, I believe, in April.
Yep.
Yeah. What do you think will happen, and how will that affect?
You know,
would that have any effect on what's happening in the Sahel?
Yes and no. Yes, because obviously a destabilized Algeria is bad news too. Because, you know, if you're talking about containing the crisis in the Sahel, you want to have the southern Algerian provinces free of drama, and you know. Here's an interesting thing. The Algerian military has been reporting on a daily basis the discovery of arms and weapons, often war grade weapons caches in the southern borders across from Mali and Niger, particularly Mali and in a region called Bourj Badji Mukhtar, which is the southwest of the country of Algeria. We're talking about rocket launchers and grenades, weapons that are really used in war environments, and those are found on really on a daily basis. So you know, is there in southern Algeria the presence of militant groups, directly or indirectly? Yes, absolutely. People have been, you know, the Algerian military has launched an initiative to, you know, pardon essentially folks that are part of these militant groups if they, you know, willingly surrender.
Yep.
And they've been doing so also on a daily basis. You see 2-3 people, you know, returning or surrendering to the military with their own weapons, providing them with intelligence of where to find arms and weapons caches. And that's a problem. That is absolutely a problem that that needs to be addressed, and that requires a stable Algeria. The problem with Algeria is the regime is, you know, has been very bad at articulating a succession, a peaceful, or at least a smooth succession to Bouteflika. They are still very much going forward with their position on maintaining the ailing 82-year-old man, and the Algerian street is fuming. There have been hundreds of thousands of people marching generally peacefully. There have been obviously some issues in the capital where, you know, the central bank, a central bank office has been burned, cars have been burned, sort of the Gilets Jaunes scenario, the yellow vest scenario. But the Algerian regime has a real bad, you know, is in bad position, and they just don't know what to do, except obviously maintaining the status quo, which could be a huge problem if the Algerian street maintains, you know, maintains all the pressure on the government.
And another question that I have. Western Sahara, I mean, that is an independentist movement with people of Tuareg Berber descent. Is it in any way connected? Does it have links to the rebels, the other Tuareg rebellion? And because I see perhaps if the idea of separating northern Mali and how that would push for more for a wider Berber state, you know, we would have poles, Western Sahara on in the west, and a northern Mali in the middle, or in between. And how that, I mean, I think it's difficult to I find it difficult to look at the region individually, because the borders, given that we're talking about a desert, the borders are so fluid. There's no and you've got this the big ethnic issue of Berbers and Tuareg that have never had their own state.
Yeah,
and the closest thing to it could be Western Sahara.
Western Sahara region is a conflict frozen in time, and I think nothing is going to happen. There's not going to be any movement anytime soon, because just like you see in Mali, just like you see anywhere else, there's really no appetite for trying to fix the problem. The problem with the Western Sahara, if any of you listeners don't know, it's a small enclave or a small territory in the northwest of the region, just below Morocco. It's a region that Morocco claims to be its own territory. It's a region that that a rebel group or a called the Polisario Front claims to be an independent state. It was kind of left, you know, in a vacuum by the Spanish. That's right. When they left the region, I think in 71, if my history...
71 or 75.
Yeah, something like that.
And just before Franco died.
Exactly. And so when the French troops left, the Moroccans wanted to annex it, and there was the creation of this group called the Polisario Front, which claims that this is an independent state. Now, nothing is going to happen for a million reasons. One is the countries and the powers that have the ability to make changes or to influence the protagonists, that is Morocco on one hand, Algeria. Polisario and Algeria on the other hand, have zero diplomatic will or political will to do so because they maintain excellent relationship with both protagonists. The moment you enter into negotiating the a peaceful settlement for the Western Sahara crisis, you might want to side with one or the other, and you know what happens. Now you're making the other one very much upset. So one is going to win, one is going to lose. And that's how it's perceived, right? I mean, obviously it doesn't have to be that way, but generally that's how it's perceived. So if you're Washington, Paris, I don't know who else, Spain, Madrid, that is in this case, involved in this thing, the UN, why would you do that? You know.
Yes. I've noticed much less interest in Europe about this. It's almost as if after the Arab Spring, this conflict went completely sideways. There were lots of humanitarian initiatives or people coming to speak on behalf of the Polisario Front in Europe before, and now it's gone silent.
Died down a little bit. Yes.
It seems.
Yeah. Each player. Uses their own, their own lobbyist groups. There's a lot of them here in Washington for both Morocco and the Polisario Front. And the argument is always the same. You know, this is our land, so we grab it. Whether you're Morocco or if you're Polisario, the same argument is the same. Now, tactically, while this is frozen, each of these groups makes, one step progress, two step backward, and that puts us back into the frozen situation. For instance, just recently the European Union signed a fisheries agreement with Morocco, which includes the territorial waters along the Western Sahara region, and the Polisario is fuming over it, obviously, because In the UN books, basically, it's not technically part of Morocco, but it's an independent entity at the moment, and there's no status quo. Therefore, therefore the Europeans should have thought about that, and that's the argument, right? On that front. On the other hand, Morocco has been working really hard to try to lobby African countries, because Algeria in particular has been making the argument that when a colonial power leaves an African region, it cannot be replaced by another colonial power, no matter what, even if it's an African nation. And that argument has been accepted by the likes of by three or four major African nations, Nigeria being one, South Africa being one, El Sisi of Egypt being another one. And if you look at where things stand at the moment, El Sisi now chairs the African Union, so that's going to be a problem for Morocco. South Africa now has joined the African Security Council, which is part of the African Union but focused on security, and so they're going to be a big problem for the Moroccans. On the other hand, South Africa has also joined the Security Council of the UN for this year. Nigeria, you have the president of Buhari re-elected. Has been re-elected. So, again, you see all these things happening. You see a lot of noise. In fact, in my estimation, the Western Sahara conflict is Morocco's biggest foreign policy flag. There is virtually nothing else happening on the foreign policy front that is not tied to its effort to annex and get support.
And that's one of the weaknesses, too, because Morocco has... also borders countries that are part of the Sahel. It's part of the routes, but it's not doing anything. I'm wondering, we hear a lot about what's happening in Mali and Niger and Burkina Faso is affecting Algeria and Libya and Chad and so on. but little about what Morocco is doing.
Well, Morocco, you know, Morocco wants to be seen as a key player in the Sahel region. Unfortunately, I mean, the truth is geographically, it's really far from being a player there, from being close to the Sahel. It is close, but it's, like they say, no cigar. You know, of course, if you take the Western Sahara region, which right now is kind of a frozen territory, if you will, because of the crisis, the only window to the Sahel is Mauritania. So again, you know, Morocco's sort of reach to the Sahel is very limited, and obviously the Moroccan press in general have made a lot of noise about the presence of Al-Qaeda and Islamist militants within the Polisario camps in Algeria's, you know, western borders. Again, that's, you know, a lot of it might be true. You know, obviously one has to expect that, you know, any group like the Polisario could be infiltrated. On the other hand, it hasn't been a big issue. We haven't seen any terror attacks. We haven't seen any militant activity there. And therefore, there's been an effort to contain any, you know, any negative movement on the Polisario front, particularly from the host country, because there's a lot of refugees in Tindouf, which is the western part of Algeria. Tindouf, yeah. And there's been a lot of noise of those camps being infiltrated, but I think the Algerian military is, you know, keeping a close eye on this. But here is, you know, another potential flashpoint that that we don't talk about a lot. When you talk about Mali lately, it's all about what's happening in the center and in the north of the country, particularly when you see all these, you know, people getting killed by IEDs.
It's all north.
Exactly. But if you go to the south, in particular the capital, there has been... Absolutely. There has been a spike in extremism, in religious extremism, coming from the Saudi Arabia-sponsored Wahhabism in particular. Mm-hmm. There's been a rise in preaching from the from preachers like Imam Diko, D-I-C-K-O, who has been calling for the resignation of the prime minister, because apparently they haven't done enough to stop the, you know, to remove the terrorists, quote unquote, from the north. But also, these are the same people that are looking for an extreme application of religious teachings into social life. And a guy like Diko, for example, Imam Diko, has been able to gather people in stadiums with crowds exceeding 60,000. So this is in the south. We can't really point
the finger. Yeah, which was not a Muslim powerhouse.
Exactly. And so you see again the penetration of radical Wahhabism into places that have always been peaceful, under the watch of Sufi Islam, and not anymore.
But this is very suspicious, because the Saudis have been sponsoring, as we talked about earlier, have been giving aid, military aid, or at least financing a lot of this aid for the G5, for the Sahel G5. So
yeah,
I wonder if this is one of the prices to pay, which means to allow preachers to... well, they're also building mosques and choosing the imams who go to these mosques and what they say. I mean, this happened in Europe too. In Belgium, for example, in the 1960s, Saudi-sponsored mosques were built in Brussels, mm-hmm. and they chose the imams, which started spreading a Wahhabi concept.
Yeah, and that's a big problem. So you know, so again, you look at all of these you know, all of these issues that we know, but there's a lot of issues that we haven't been paying attention to, you know, that that are a huge problem for the region, and again, there's very little appetite for fixing that.
Mali borders with Nigeria, correct?
Mali doesn't have a border with Nigeria. Mali has a border with another flashpoint country, Burkina Faso. But if you talk about Nigeria, you have...
Yeah, Boko Haram is not going anywhere. They've been influencing their borders as well, with cross-bordering, I believe, causing problems in the neighborhood, not just at home.
Yes, absolutely. It's clear that the other third flashpoint, if you look at the entire region, it begins with, you know, if you look at sort of the cancer cells or this cluster of events that are affecting, you know, their neighbors. You start with Libya, obviously, and we saw, you know, the impact, you know, around Libya. Then you move to Mali, which is sort of the second cluster of problems, and that's affecting everyone else. The third one is really Nigeria, even though it's generally not, you know, considered a Sahelian country. It part of it, the northern part.
The border.
Yes, the northern part is definitely anchored.
Niger is right. Directly north.
Well, Nigeria is definitely anchored in the northern part of Nigeria is definitely anchored in the Sahel. Because of the geography, because of the ethnic makeup, because of the, you know, a lot of other things. Obviously, it's not just an extension of the Sahel, but northern Nigeria is also part of the Sahel. And what's happening there, the problem that started in Borno, as you pointed out before, has basically spread to northern areas from Niger in southern Niger
to Chad.
Yeah, to western Chad, to western Cameroon,
and the Central African Republic,
all over the map. And so you know, absolutely, these three fronts are creating a sense of destabilization in the region, and they are continuing to wreak havoc as they continue to move. I mean, remember, Burkina Faso was a relatively peaceful place. Well, it's been carried away by the terror tsunami, if I call it. And right now, Burkina is facing tens of thousands of refugees, people being displaced from their homes, terror attacks happening on a regular basis, people getting kidnapped, local ones to foreign workers. It's all over them.
Didn't we have some Burkina Faso was the there was a hotel that was attacked, I believe, 2017, and then there was another major terror attack in 2018.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's that sort of
partner.
Yes, that's sort of what started to concern Westerners, in particular France.
Yeah.
The armed forces have been brutal. I mean, the Burkina military, you know, releasing, for example, statements that they killed 30 suspected militants in one operation. And I tell you, I mean, it's easy to believe that to take a statement from a government and just publish it. You've got to be concerned that there is no oversight, no independent review of what's happening. We don't know. I mean, we hear that these are militants. We call them suspected militants in our publications and in our research. But there's a lot of happening there that basically means
beyond oversight. There's no, and there are a few journalists.
Yes, I mean, there aren't. You know, most of what you see are basically reported by newswire agencies following releases of press, of press statements.
Press release.
And at the end of the day, you know, one has to be careful and take with a grain of salt what these governments are saying. Nevertheless, the truth is that Burkina Faso has been destabilized by the drama that's happening in Mali. Just the way you see Niger, Chad, and Cameroon being destabilized by Boko Haram, based in Borno, northern Nigeria.
Yeah.
And that's that's a pretty bleak picture of the region.
One of the big problems I see long term, or at a structural level, is the competition that's building between China and the United States. And I think Africa is one of the places where the competition will play itself out. Just as during the Cold War, we had the Soviets and Americans playing out these games in various parts of the world, South America, but Africa, again, was one of these areas. And I think, I mean, who's investing a lot in Mozambique? It's China. They're even building a bridge to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They're finally doing the things that the Europeans should have done. All kinds of roads, railways, connecting the continent. One of the big problems the continent has is a lack of transportation. So when they want to trade, they can't really trade with each other. It's cheaper to trade with the outside world because of sea routes than it is to trade in the interior of Africa because of a lack of roads. And what roads there are usually unsafe and easily prone to predatory attacks. So
But specific to Mozambique, I agree that the Chinese have been have been present there, helping the government of Mozambique when other partners basically didn't want to do anything to help, because there has been a financial scandal, a debt, to call it a debt crisis, if you will. Because Mozambique borrowed money, $2 billion of which were never reported to the IMF or to the international community when the country was negotiating economic aid. And that really upset, and I'm going to use a bad word, pissed off pretty much everyone that used to be has been a donor from the World Bank to the IMF to bilateral help. And so they said, as long as you don't come clean with the scandal, we're just going to withhold any support. Instead, the Chinese came along and have been helping a little bit, but not substantially enough, basically to tell the Mozambican that the Chinese are our friends. On the other hand, we've seen a substantial amount of investments pouring into the north of the country because of gas. And when you talk about gas and oil, now all of a sudden you pique the interest.
These are self-interested. What the Chinese are doing, along with their extractions and so on, they're leaving behind necessary infrastructure.
They do. Yes, that's right.
In the long term, benefits the entire continent in huge ways, not just in gas. But I think that there is definitely, I don't know, I see the beginnings of a new, I already see the beginnings of a new Cold War between China and the United States.
Yeah, so what happened recently, specific to Mozambique, and I know this is not specific to our talk about the Sahel, but you could see some parallels for sure, and so it's helpful to talk about that. The proliferation of investments and the potential for this so-called Rovuma Basin, gas basin, to become one of Africa's biggest source of gas, has brought billions of dollars, bringing billions of dollars, until one thing happened, and now is basically this proliferation of small-scale attacks. And we're not talking about, major explosions of oil facilities, but we're talking about, small groups of four or five men attacking little villages and...
Yeah, it's similar to what happened in Nigeria, what continues to happen in Nigeria with the separatist movements in the south, with MEND and so on. Kidnappings of technicians, a small interruption here. They're just little headaches that make it difficult for foreign companies to go in and conduct business.
Exactly. And so what happened recently, just as recently as a week, 2 weeks ago, foreign powers, Western powers in particular, have been showing up in Maputo to basically tell the Mozambican government, hey, we're here. Now remember, there is a major gas reserves to protect, and the companies that are active there are the usual suspects. You know, on the engineering front is Anadarko, which is a U.S. company. On the exploration and production front is Eni, from Italy. There's also oil companies from the U.S. that are actively involved. When you have that kind of assets involved and opportunities for gas exploration and production, you automatically get the militaries of those countries involved. And so, just as as last week alone, or 2 weeks ago, sorry, there's been naval exercises involving 17 countries led by the U.S. And so the Chinese might be there investing in building basic infrastructure. At the end of the day, if there is a real financial gains through oil and gas in particular, then Western powers are going to show up. And they did.
Yes, but that's the unfortunate thing. They only show up then, and let's put it, be clear, gas and oil extraction, great for revenue, not great for employment. They don't lift the standards of living that much because they don't hire local people, or if they do, they're in a minor capacity. And in general, oil industry and gas extraction do not require huge numbers of people anymore. They require expensive equipment.
Exactly. Technology, productivity, all of that basically nullified the need to... get local content, local employees, for sure.
Causes that, really, that develop that oil industry malaise. It brings revenue without leaving strong roots. I compare Tunisia and Libya. One of the reasons Tunisia was able to work out its revolt and establish what seems to be the one democracy in North Africa. They're going to have elections toward the end of the year, which will be a real test of this theory. But Tunisia had a better prepared population because they didn't have they weren't spoiled by oil. Mm-hmm. And they had to develop some kind of institutions, whereas oil-rich, resource-rich countries, really all you have to do is develop the oil and gas sector. And then distribute the money. If you can, Libya had the advantage; it was a very small population, so it just bought it the way out of its problems. And what's happening now, without a central authority distributing that money as it was during Gaddafi's time, we have a huge mess.
Yeah, and none of that. There is no economic prospect for the Sahel, going back into our main topic, right? For anyone to pay attention. So, I mean, unless, obviously, it's an extension of the Sahara Desert. So there's got to be some reserves of mineral reserves above and beyond.
Well, there are. There's uranium, gold, and oil, but perhaps not in the quantities.
Yes.
And concentrations that... attract big players, rather just small ones.
And the outlook, perhaps as a way to conclude the talk, the outlook looks pretty grim. I mean, look at the general demographics. A half a billion people live in the Sahel. When you include sort of all the countries we've talked about, plus the northern zones of Nigeria, for instance. The region has no water. It is extremely hot, and poverty is essentially the primary characteristic of the local populations in general. And I'm reading that in a recent meeting held, I think, on the 25th of February, just last week, 17 countries met to discuss climate change and its impact on the Sahel. It's kind of a little weird to actually, kind of ludicrous to talk about, to frame the discussion this way, because it's already in its worst. I can't imagine worse than that.
Yeah, but it's always been.
Yeah, exactly.
It's always been. And before, there was a they had their own economy. They, the Tuareg were merchants, and it was a transfer point. It was just a route.
Yeah.
Settled areas. I recommend listeners watch a movie called The Sheltering Sky,
mm-hmm.
if they want to understand what the Tsavo looks like and its traditional economic base.
Ah, great, thank it's, you. I'm set not aware in the 1940s,
of it. But mm-hmm. yeah, oh, it's a Bertolucci film yeah. from the 1990s.
Ah, fantastic.
It's all entirely set in the Sahel.
In conclusion, when you look at what these countries need, setting aside an impossible goal of stopping war, right? So let's assume they're able to stop war, which is not going to happen because that's nobody wants peace. These countries need. You ready to hear this number? $400 billion between now and 2030, dealing with essentially climate change. $400 billion.
Billion.
Yeah,
that is not, you know, I was expecting worse.
Oh.
I considering how many billionaires there are in the world, if each gave, donated a small portion... instead of just talking about it, they always just talk, and at Davos they show up in their jets and they talk, when instead a real cash donation, if all of them got together $500,000, they could come up with that amount.
Except they will not. Except they will not. You think about it, yeah. $400 billion is... it probably the combined GDP of the entire African continent for many years.
Yeah, that's true. But it's also the combined wealth of four or five of the world's top billionaires.
It is true. But I remain very skeptical as to the ability of donor countries or anybody to come up with money like this over a 10-year period, because we're talking about 10 years. You know, that's roughly $40 billion a year. That's a lot of money. On the other hand, again, that assumes that peace has been restored. Unfortunately, every aspect and factors that has a destabilizing effect is magnifying. Whether
yeah, everything, there's nothing to, and that is really the point of this conversation. Nothing seems to... predict any good news from this region for next, certainly in 2019 and beyond.
Absolutely, absolutely. And with this very pessimistic conclusion, Alessandro, thank you for your time, and I look forward to the next discussion.